Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's that time of century again, a little American ritual all about who's, what, where, and when. A monster every decade snapshot of the USA we call the census.
The further adventures of Larry Cogswell, official census taker. He is America.
That's right, there's nothing more American than census takers, and the adventure of the census is our focus all week as the constitutionally empowered census taker ground troops prepare to deploy to a neighborhood near you with all their little questions and one big one. Can a nation this big truly know itself? Find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. On this Monday morning, March 15th, welcome to the further adventures of the U.S. Census. We're going to be exploring that all week. Lynn Scherr joins me today.
In for Celeste Headlee.
Good morning.
Good morning, John. And let's start with a check of the morning's top news. Two U.S. embassy workers in Mexico are dead in what's believed to be the first attack on American officials and their families by the country's powerful drug cartels. Gunmen, believed to be linked to drug traffickers, shot a consulate worker and her husband in the border town of Juarez with their newborn baby in the back seat. They also killed the husband of another consular employee and wounded his two young children. President Obama expressed outrage at what he called the brutal murders. Fred Lash is a spokesman for the U.S. State Department.
This is totally uncalled for. It's brutal. It's egregious, and we have to work very closely with the Mexican government to try to decrease and cease and stop this particular these incidents of violence.
The shootings took place within minutes of each other in broad daylight as the victims were on their way home from a social gathering.
A Defense Department official is under investigation for hiring private contractors to gather intelligence on suspected insurgents in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our partner, The New York Times, reports the contractors sent the intelligence to military units who may have used it for airstrikes. It's against U.S. policy to use contractors as spies. As we mentioned, let the counting begin. More than 120 million census forms begin arriving in mailboxes around the country today. The government once in a decade census population count will be used to divvy up congressional seats and more than $400 billion in federal aid. We're joined now by Erwin Clare, team leader and senior partnership specialist for the Brooklyn Census Bureau. Good morning, Erwin.
Good morning.
So are all your troops wired up with GPS devices, walkie-talkies, and fancy computers to do this mother of all data downloads?
No, we're not.
It's just a basic
load. We're not.
You're just walking the streets.
No. We're not doing that at this point yet. The walk in the street is primarily outreach at this point. That point that you're talking about would be the enumeration process where people go back to people's households who did not respond to the census, and they won't have GPS.
All right.
They won't be wired up like that.
Erwin Clare, stay with us. Just basic Q&A with the census. We're going to be exploring that in just a moment.
John, it's make or break week for health care. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs is confident.
We'll have the votes when the House votes, I think, within the next week.
But the top Democratic vote counter in the House says there are not enough votes at this time to pass the bill.
Last week, it was U.S. governors talking about education reform. Today, the president will outline his proposals to rewrite the No Child Left Behind law with less emphasis on standardized testing. And NCAA March Madness brackets. It's the official office pool, otherwise known as March Madness, the tournament for the NCAA basketball championship. The top seeds, if you don't know already, are Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, and Syracuse. More on that later in the program. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,624. The S&P opens at 1,149. The NASDAQ at 2367. We want to say a big good morning, Baltimore, to our listeners in WEAA in Baltimore. The Takeaway is starting an hour earlier. Love to have you aboard. And coming up in our family segment, a relook at breastfeeding versus formula. The formula is fine crowd may be coming back into the mainstream. And this morning, thinking about the census and learning about the shrinking populations in some cities, we want your eyes on the ground. Is your city shrinking? And why? Show us the signs of population changes in your city at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the census. Good morning and happy Monday to everyone. Lynn, you know, the census The history of the census goes back to the Roman Empire, but the regularity of U.S. censuses is a bit of an innovation for our particular democracy. What's the first census you remember?
I certainly remember as a kid having the census taker come to my house,
sure.
Probably in the 50s is what I remember. I'm sure it was before that. I have to tell you, though, I love the census because when I did some research on my family, do you know that all the old census records are online?
That's amazing.
And you can go look stuff up and find out about your grandparents, where they lived, and it's cool stuff.
It's a huge data set, and it's about to get bigger. And you know, the census kind of sneaks up on you each decade without warning, kind of when you least expect it.
Come see to shining sea. No place like your own backyard, that's for sure.
Hello?
Excuse me?
excuse me, yeah, right. I've got a few questions for you.
Hey, watch the daffodils there, pal.
Sorry, what's your name?
Albert O'Malkovinoshevsky.
O'Malkovinoshevsky. All righty. Nice big place you've got here, Mr. O'Malkovinoshevsky. How many people live here?
Me, my wife, my kids, you know. Hey, why are you asking this stuff?
And their ages, please?
My wife is 34.
Okay.
My oldest son is 17. Then we have an 11-year-old, my daughter, 9, and a new 7-month-old baby girl.
Right. Girl 0.
Excuse me?
Your baby girl is a 0 now. You own this place or rent?
Hey, who are you?
Just call me Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of your constitution, fella. Now, any of the people staying with you, are they Asian Indian?
No.
Chinese?
No.
Filipino?
No.
How about Samoans?
Hey, look, what's this all about?
I need your phone number, please.
I'm not giving you my phone number.
You better, or you could lose representation, political power, you could lose the chance at billions of dollars in federal revenue.
I beg your pardon?
Almost done. Mr. Malkovinoshevsky. What kind of a name is that? Irish? Polish? Hispanic?
It's Samoan.
Really?
Right.
Hey, whoa. It is un-American to lie to me, pal.
Look, I'm about ready to call the police here.
Police? They'd give you the ticket. I'm Larry Cogswell, official census taker.
I am America.
You know, it is fun and irresistible to make fun of the census, but there's nothing more American. And here to talk about it, we welcome back Erwin Clare, team leader and senior partnership specialist for the Brooklyn Census Bureau, out there doing all the enumeration in some of the more challenging neighborhoods to actually do a census count in. Is that right, Erwin?
That is absolutely correct, Larry. And by the way, there's no Larry on our team, all right?
There's no Larry on your team. Okay, yeah. Don't call me Larry Cogsworth. He's a figment of my imagination. Also joining us is Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Are you a pro census guy, Sam, or do you buy into this whole fear of government that the census stories are filled with this time around?
No, most of the people who are afraid of government benefit from the census. As you mentioned earlier, the census is used to dole out about $400 or $500 billion in federal assistance, Medicaid assistance based on income, population, to some extent enforces civil rights and anti-discrimination laws. And the most important thing, perhaps, is that the reapportionment of congressional and legislative districts, ultimately the electoral college itself, is based on the population estimates of the U.S. Census. So it is very important to the way our democracy runs.
Originally, Sam, in the Constitution, it was really only about determining the representation, how many congressional districts. But it, as you've said, has evolved to basically determine the formulas for distribution of almost all federal revenue.
That's true. Under the Constitution, the census is taken every 10 years for reapportionment purposes to make sure that we adhere basically to the one man, one person, one vote dictum. A lot of other questions have been added on over the years to help us guide federal programs and federal policies. This year, though, the census form is only 10 questions long for everyone. In past years, there was usually a long form sent to some people. Most of the others got the short form. This year, it's 10 for everyone, because most of those other questions have been replaced by the annual American Community Survey, which gives a much more timely and accurate picture of who we are as a country.
We're getting too big to just do a census once every 10 years. Erwin Clare, senior specialist for the Brooklyn Census Bureau, what are you doing to try to convince people to maybe disclose more information and not to slam their doors in your faces?
Well, basically, one of the things that the 2010 census has invested heavily in this time around is our partnership approach, where many people are employed representing the communities from whence they are to form relationships with community groups, community-based organizations, businesses, to help to supplement the process of getting to especially the hard-to-count region. We find that when we have persons from the community or of the community communicating the message, it helps to supplement the process as opposed to just having government employees like ourselves articulating the importance of census. So we have a strong relationship with the clergy, a strong relationship with community-based organizations and businesses as part of our outreach to the community.
And you've even teamed up with Steve Harvey, the comedian.
Well, the Steve Harvey Show is one such entity that the Census Bureau has partnered with. And just today as we speak, you know, he's broadcasting live from Crown Heights at one of our centers here. And there are several hundred people are out to hear him. And we're out. We'll be broadcasting the program this morning as well.
Right. And an effort all to try to counter this kind of fear that really came into our inbox last week from one of our listeners. Listen to this.
It's amazing. The Census Bureau is going to register probably about 25 million illegal aliens and undocumented workers. Therefore, the communities and towns and cities can get enough tax dollars that the federal government will dispense back to them so that they can support the illegal aliens.
Sam Roberts, how do you evaluate that level of cynicism from our listener, Rick, there?
Not only cynical, it's unconstitutional. The Constitution of the United States says the census counts all residents of the United States. It doesn't differentiate between immigrants and not, legal or not, all residents, and that's what the census is simply supposed to do.
Erwin Clare, do you find people who distinguish between undocumented immigrants and American citizens?
Yeah, without a doubt, especially in the areas that we cover here, it's largely an immigrant group. So they come with their cultures, maybe that they had a great distrust of governments from where they're from. Many are here who may be immigration challenged, may also be in homes where they are legal residents.
But it does say residents. It says in the Constitution residents, and that's the issue. Erwin Clare, thanks so much. Talking about the challenges there in Brooklyn, that's his territory, and Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. What's at stake in the census on The Takeaway? And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following, Lynn.
John, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says reconstruction in Haiti is moving quickly. The UN chief is in Haiti on his second visit since January's earthquake. He said he's working hard to keep donor funds flowing into the country.
Seldom in history has there been such an outpouring of support and heartfelt solidarity.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has apologized again for announcing a plan to build homes in East Jerusalem during Joe Biden's Middle East tour last week. Speaking on NBC's Meet the Press, President Obama's chief political advisor, David Axelrod, said the plan has damaged the Middle East peace process.
This was an affront. It was an insult. But most importantly, it undermined this very fragile effort to bring peace to that region.
Here at home, President Obama is trying to nail down enough votes to pass his health care reform plans. He'll head to Ohio today with another sales pitch. The top Democratic vote counter in the House says the plan still lacks enough support to pass.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's wife is out of the hospital after being injured in a car accident last week. Landra Reid suffered a broken neck and back, but doctors say she's not at risk of paralysis. Finally, we say goodbye to Mission Impossible actor Peter Graves. Perhaps best known for his portrayal of Jim Phelps, leader of a gang of special agents who battled evil conspirators, he had a second career as an airline pilot, Captain Over, in the series Airplane. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the brackets have been set. Kansas is number one. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen will take us through the tournament.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'm Lynn Scherr, in for Celeste Headlee today. And ever since the financial crisis began, there's been lots of talk about financial reform. Well, later today, Connecticut Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd, in his role as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, unveils a new and broad financial overhaul bill. You might think everyone would welcome this latest attempt at reform. You would be wrong. Joining us to map out its path is our friend Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Morning, Louise.
Good morning.
So what's in the bill? What do we expect to see out of this? And give us the layout.
So it's been broadly telegraphed. Of course, we don't know. The bill won't be released until 2 p.m. today. But if you were on Twitter last night, you would have seen the press secretary for the Senate Banking Committee on there tweeting that they were on track. What I think is notable is what's not in this bill. If you remember, in January, President Obama came out with a very dramatic proposal where he would separate proprietary trading. He would not let banks do this kind of risky trading or own hedge funds. That's not in this bill. Also not in this bill.
Why is it not in the bill?
Well, Dodd will do an interview today. I think that'll be a top question for him. Some people have said it's perhaps the reason is because it would be too divisive. It might not pass. And it was proposed by the president very late. The other thing the president has proposed since last summer that's not in this bill is an independent agency for consumer protection. This bill is expected to put the Consumer Protection Agency inside the Federal Reserve.
And how is the Fed going to be taking this?
Well, the Fed is getting an increase and a decrease in its powers in different aspects of this bill. So getting consumer protection is certainly a win for them. Consumer advocates are very skeptical because, you know, the Fed did not fully protect consumers during the run-up in the housing bubble. So people are skeptical. The Fed will be losing some of its regulatory power over smaller bank holding companies. The other thing that is supposed to be in this bill is the New York Fed, which is very close to Wall Street, is going to be separated a bit from the banks, and there won't be able to be bank executives on the board of the New York Fed. That's a very big change for them. So the Fed kind of is a mixed bag. It gains some powers, loses some. The consumer protection one is controversial.
And how do the consumers do out of all this?
Again, it will depend on whether the Fed really steps up and uses the greater resources it gets to watch out for them. And the problem is the Fed will have a dual rule. One, on the one hand, the Fed will have to make sure banks are safe and sound. But on the other hand, they'll have to make sure that consumers are not being ripped off. Mm-hmm. And those two roles can come into conflict. Sometimes you want protection for consumers that costs money to banks and hurts their profits and might eat away at their capital levels. So that's the conflict.
You know, in some sense, this is about Dodd, too. Is he a captive of the industry that he's overseen
it's
for
from
so
Connecticut.
Long? Right. Or is this his kind of populist last stand and it's going to really test his power in the Senate?
This is his moment to show whether he, you know, stands up for the people and for consumer protection or whether he's a lot closer to Wall Street.
I realize you don't know the specifics of the bill at this point, Louise, but from what you know and from the mood in Congress, will what the senator wants pass?
So he's moving ahead without Republicans. They had tried to reach an agreement, and he just threw it out the door last week and said, I'm going ahead without them. But they've got 60 legislative days or so. And what Democrats are saying is that there's some Republicans who will probably swing over and support this. It looks like it might even have a better chance than health care in some people's view of getting Republican support. So we'll have to see.
And you said 2 o'clock it's being released?
Yes.
Okay. We'll be watching.
Stay tuned.
Okay. John?
Our other big story, of course, sports. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here, Takeaway Sports contributor. The brackets are set. The four top seeds are clear. Kansas, actually some friends from Kansas actually visited me yesterday and they brought little kid KU shirts for all our kids to wear. Kansas is the number one seed. Who are the other three?
I don't know if America's ready, first of all, but for what's going to happen this year. Syracuse is in the number one seed.
Not a surprise.
Duke is in the number one seed.
Not a surprise.
And who's the last?
Kentucky,
correct. Yeah. Well, that's not a surprise at all because Kentucky is actually one of my favorites to get to the Final Four without a doubt. This is a really tough year, and the reason why I said I don't know if America is ready is because this has been a topsy-turvy year, particularly at the top of the bracket. The top 10 teams have been switching in and out, but in that topsy-turvy, it's been consistent. So what you're going to see is a lot of the bubble teams and the teams that just got in they don't have the same level of talent. You're not going to see as many upsets this year, but you'll see some of these top teams that have been doing this dance at the top get to the finals.
Is that because of the way they manipulated the brackets? In other words, is the selection process all about preventing upsets or what?
If you're Kansas, then you're you're angry about the way the bracket's been set up because you have the most treacherous road, but you have the best, you have the longest run at number one all season and the number one seed overall. If you're Duke and if you're one of these people that loves to hate Duke, then you're going to really hate Duke this year because they're the worst number one seed, but they have the easiest road to the finals. So there is some magic and some trickery with the brackets.
So who's the Butler University this year? Who's the dark horse, the strange town? Does Gonzaga have a chance? Does Xavier have a chance?
You know, right now I like Cornell, and I'll explain why. They have the best three-point percentage in the country, and they have this guy Jason Witten who has played really good against top talent. He scored 24 against Kansas earlier this year. And I like Cornell to do some upsets early on. Siena's another one that's primed to get some upsets, and same with Marquette.
Now, last night at the supermarket, across the fish counter, they were having a heated argument, Syracuse versus Kansas. And the guy who was handling the tuna was saying that Kansas all the way, you can't stop Kansas. There's no way to stop Kansas. And the other guys in the fish were saying, I'm with Syracuse, but they're a heartbreaker.
Syracuse is a heartbreaker. I love Syracuse. So is Rhode Island, who didn't get in, and they broke my heart by not getting in.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at teams that have that come in on a roll, that's what you look for. If they came in on a roll, they came in on a win streak, those are the teams that I would go for and that would predict.
And Kansas has
come in on a roll.
And if you take the last part of the season, Syracuse is that way, although they have some injuries to worry about.
Syracuse is going to have a difficult role. Their center, Onuaku, he is not healthy, and I would not pick Syracuse if he's not healthy.
All right. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Stay with us. What's on the agenda this week? Coming up, healthcare reform, the 7th anniversary of the Iraq War, Hillary Clinton's trip to Russia, and what's going on down on the border, the deaths over the weekend in Juarez, in just a few minutes.
I'm Lynn Scherr, filling in for Celeste Headlee, and coming up, the future of healthcare reform, the 7-year anniversary of the Iraq War, and Hillary Clinton's trip to Russia. Those stories and more, all part of the agenda this week. That's in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, here's some of the news stories we are following at 30 minutes past the hour. More than 100 million census forms begin hitting mailboxes today. The once-a-decade population count is used to decide congressional districts and more than $400 billion in federal aid.
That's certainly on the agenda. Also this, the Mexican drug cartels are believed to be behind the ambush and murder of two U.S. embassy officials in the border town of Juarez. U.S. consulates across northern Mexico have begun sending family members out of the area because of concerns about rising drug violence. Toyota plans a news conference this morning to release its findings on the alleged sudden acceleration of that Prius on a California highway. Maybe you saw the pictures. The attorney for Prius owner James Sykes says it's no surprise that investigators have not been able to replicate the incident.
There's a ghost in these Toyota systems. There's a ghost in the machine that doesn't leave a trace. There's not a fault code you can look to. You can't replicate it. That's the problem. It doesn't prove anything.
Well, it may prove. Reports that over the weekend suggested that the California incident may, in fact, have been a hoax. But police say at this point there is no evidence of that. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down at this point. The Dow gets underway at 10,624. The S&P opens at 1,149. And the NASDAQ at 2,367. And again, futures suggest a negative opening in a few hours. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our health care.
A new relationship with Iraq.
So let me talk about the census.
Comprehensive, meaningful reform.
Nightmare on Wall Street.
It is Monday morning, and that means it's time to check out what's on the agenda. Joining us today is Marcus Mabry, International Business Editor for our partner, The New York Times. Morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
So let's start with Mexico. Terrible news from the border at Juarez in Jalisco State. Those consular officials gunned down. What does this mean?
Really horrific news. I mean, the scene itself is one that, you know, would be the very definition of terror. You know, an encyclopedia was a consular official and her husband killed, leaving their newborn baby wailing in the backseat. Really horrific. It was really important to point out that this was a very violent weekend in which 50 people across the country died in drug gang-related violence. So
not just Americans,
exactly,
in other words. Right?
2,500 have died in Juarez.
This is an example.
Yeah.
This is a plague on Mexico.
It's bloody. It's murderous. It's just terrible. So,
exactly.
So does that mean, of course, I mean, are we losing the drug war? Is there, what does this say about U.S.-Mexico relations?
Well, there's been increasing tension on the relationship. relationship because of this. This is only going to increase that tension. The last time we saw this was when the DEA official was killed a long time ago. And it really made a difference in how the U.S. prosecuted this war and how the U.S.-Mexico, they kind of they increase their commitment to fighting this war at that point. As we can see, long term it has made a difference, but in the short term it does make a difference. In the short term, there is a new dedication to it. The Mexicans take a new seriousness with it. This is a problem of corruption that sinks very deeply into the Mexican soul, and Mexicans themselves have complained about it as a people. Rooting out that corruption is really, really hard to do.
And
I think we can expect real efforts over the next weeks.
Obviously, President Obama already on the case. We'll hear more about that. Let's talk about health care. This is obviously going to dominate the news, and even the President of the United States, Mr. Obama, has delayed a trip to Indonesia to help push his reform. And the President's senior advisor, David Axelrod, was on ABC This Week yesterday predicting that the votes are there.
I believe we will have them. It is it's been a long and arduous debate. It's a tough issue for members of Congress because there's an enormous lobbying campaign. A lobbyist from the insurance industry descending on Capitol Hill like locusts and trying to pressure people to vote against this bill. There's a lot of pressure on people, but I believe that we'll be there at the end of the day.
Okay, Marcus Mabry, locusts or president? Who wins?
Well, I'll tell you, either way, Lynn, whatever happens is going to affect the rest of this presidency. If President Obama is not able to get this done, if his advisors this late in the game are going out there and saying they have the votes, the Republicans are still saying the Democrats do not have the votes. If it turns out the Democrats don't have the votes and health care does not happen, this president, you know, will be say a lame duck with 2.5 years left.
You know what it looks like, though, is if you take the Coakley,
Martha Coakley
race in
Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. And look at the various deadlines we've had over and over and over again on health care. I mean, this administration seems really good at setting itself up for a fall.
Well, you know, this would be the most extraordinary fall yet, John, because this president will get nothing done. None of the big items.
Well, it'll have been a wasted congressional year, right?
Well, and we're already headed toward that. We'll be looking at a second wasted congressional year, probably with very significant Republican gains in both houses, if not taking one or the other, if they don't get this done. So there's no way to overstate the importance of this with regards to this presidency. Now, one can say it was a strategic mistake, as you're implying, John, for the administration to allow it to get to this point, where it comes down to one piece of legislation, no matter how huge it is, affecting a huge percentage of our economy, 18%, 16% of our gross domestic product goes to health care. That's not good enough. No administration should have its entire future dependent upon one vote.
That's an
extraordinary mistake.
I agree.
Let's stay with President Obama. As I just mentioned, he delayed his trip to Indonesia, his boyhood home, mm-hmm. so that he could be here for the health care vote. But he is now going to leave on Sunday. What's on the agenda in Indonesia?
Well, it's going to be interesting. Indonesia is an incredibly important country. It's the largest Muslim country in the world. A lot of people don't realize that. It's a very different kind of Islam than you see in the Middle East, but very, very important. It's also very important because it's kind of the vanguard of the president's kind of international presence and persona. Ironically, he's going to be greeted there like a conquering hero in a way he has not been greeted in Washington in some time. The danger of it, and I really thought about it when this trip was canceled. Originally, it was due to start this week on Thursday. When this trip was canceled, I kind of hearkened back to Jimmy Carter becoming a victim of the Iranian crisis at the end of his presidency. He would stop all his travel. He wouldn't leave the country. You can imagine this president, if this trip has to be postponed yet again, really bringing up shades of Carter.
That Carter comparison, that's just got to be a sort of Damocles.
Not a good one for him.
No,
not one you want to hear. Let's go on to John's favorite topic now, which is the census. The forms come in.
The census.
I was very happy when I got most of us got our first piece of mail last week saying
it's coming.
Something from us, and I was very excited. I remember filling out my family's 20 years ago.
I know it is fun. So all right, on the way, Iraq. Let's go to Iraq now. Friday will be 7 years since the war in Iraq started. U.S. troops any closer to getting pulled out?
Yes, we are. The elections this week, which you know have not had a affirmative ending yet.
By the way, very slow returns on that, no?
Very slow, very slow. And I don't know if that's political, if that's also technical. It is still a developing country. But, you know, somewhere George W. Bush may be smiling at this moment, saying, you know, mission accomplished, much later than he originally said that. But American troops will be out a year from now, and that's a significant number. We will have a presence there for a long time. It's not as significant or as obvious, but strategic nonetheless. It is looking right now like an accomplishment. One is really hesitant to ever, you know, really hark, you know, the kind of pound one's chest about accomplishments in Iraq. But right now, it's looking relatively good. The sacrifice of American blood and treasure seems to have achieved something. But, you know, again, we're reminded of the violence in Fallujah that it's never really over.
Right. And well, we're coming up on that. Just very quickly, Secretary of State Clinton going to Russia. What's on the agenda there? She's going to be attending a meeting of the Quartet of Middle East Mediators, European Union, UN, Russia, and the U.S.
We need Russia to help us, especially in Iran. So diplomacy and working together is on the agenda.
Okay. Now, we're going to close out with your personal recommendation. What should we look out for this week?
Well, this is, you know, totally on a much lighter note. Alice in Wonderland is on my personal agenda this week.
The movie.
Oh, yeah. I love Alice in Wonderland. Cool. I'm going to. Marcus Mabry from our partner, The New York Times, with the agenda for this week.
We go live now to Bangkok, Thailand, where there's been really for almost a week now a test of the sovereignty of the Thai government. Rachel Harvey joins us, BBC correspondent in Bangkok, where there are mass anti-government protests going on in Bangkok this morning. Rachel, first of all, let us know what's going on around you.
Well, I'm just back at the main rallying point in the old town of Bangkok, and the protesters are gathering again here. Earlier today, they'd moved from here to an army barracks, and that was the focus of several hours of demonstrations. The army barracks is being used by the government as its main command and control centre while these protests are going on. So that's why the protesters have decided to go out there and make a show of force. And they did completely block the road in front of those army barracks. There were tens of thousands of red-shirted protesters. That's the uniform of choice for these anti-government demonstrators. They were waving flags, singing songs. It was all quite good-natured. These soldiers were on the other side of the iron railings in their riot gear, but it was all very good-natured and peaceful. And now the protesters have dispersed from that one point. They're coming back to this main rallying point. Their leaders are already here and up on a stage giving speeches.
And the protesters want a new election. They want the prime minister to step down, and they want to sort of reset the table here. Is there a sense that that's what the broad population of Thailand wants, or are the protesters a small group here?
The protesters are a fairly large group, but Thailand is absolutely split down the middle. It splits along rural urban lines. It's split along class lines. The red shirt movement say they are fighting for what they would call genuine democracy and for, as they would put it, a modern Thailand. They want to move the country forward, and they're fighting against, they say, a privileged establishment, an elite that are just holding on to power for its own ends. Now, the current coalition government is a pretty fractious bunch of various different parties. So the Prime Minister, on the one hand, is under pressure from within his own coalition. He's also under pressure from these protesters. And it really has been going on, these divisions, ever since the military coup of 2006, which ousted the former Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra, from power.
Well, as you mentioned, the military coup, I mean, the army is keeping order. The military is keeping order at this point, and there are reports of attacks on military installations. Any sense that the military's patience has a limit and that they might tip their hand and support either the protesters or the government?
That is always the underlying fear here, and there have been persistent rumours of an imminent coup for months, literally for months. But the army absolutely denies that it has any such plans. It says it does still back the government, and at the moment there's no sign at all of them wanting to intervene. They have a government in place that they can live with. The army doesn't want to be seen to be intervening in Thai politics again. It did it in 2006. It really doesn't want to get involved again. At the moment, the atmosphere is still very peaceful. It is good-natured. It almost has a bit of a party feel at times, with lots of music being played. The security forces are quite deliberately standing back. They are not confronting the protesters. They're holding their ground. They're protecting main government buildings. But they're not out in large numbers where the main protest is happening. They're just letting the demonstrators get on with it. And I think that is really the strategy of the government and the security forces, that they're hoping that the protesters will eventually burn themselves out. After all, eventually, these people are going to presumably have to go back to their lives and their jobs.
Indeed.
And a lot of these people have come great distances.
Rachel Harvey, BBC correspondent, reporting from Bangkok, Thailand. If history is any guide, the party atmosphere could change very, very quickly, but we'll be watching that.
I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for Celeste Headlee this morning, here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, is breast really best? After a long time in exile, the formula is fine crowd may be coming back into the mainstream. A breastfeeding update in a few minutes on this week's family segment. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The once-in-a-decade census count begins today. More than 120 million census forms will start to arrive in mailboxes around the country. The population count will be used to distribute more than $400 billion in federal aid. Earlier, we spoke to Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
Ultimately, the Electoral College itself is based on the population estimates of the U.S. Census, so it is very important to the way our democracy runs.
In other news, the U.S. has authorized dependents of its officials based in Mexican border cities to leave following deadly attacks by suspected drug traffickers on consular staff and their families. President Obama expressed outrage at the killings and said the U.S. would help track down the perpetrators.
The Chinese certainly know how to rail the financial markets, and you can see that this morning. The U.S. Treasury Department has a month to decide whether or not China is a so-called currency manipulator. But speaking over the weekend, Chinese leader Wen Jiabao denied that the yuan is undervalued. Instead, he emphasized his concerns about the lack of stability in the U.S. dollar. BBC's Chris Hogg joins us from Shanghai. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
And, you know, what is the nature of this discussion? It's back and forth between the U.S. and the Chinese about whether the yuan should float, whether the yuan is undervalued deliberately, or whether the dollar is falling apart. Where does the dispute stand at this point?
Well, basically, China's competitors see the economy here really powering ahead, and they don't understand why, if the economy here is powering ahead, the value of the currency is so low. Since the middle of 2008, the yuan has in effect been pegged to the US dollar, and as the value of the dollar has fallen, the value of the yuan has fallen too. And that's why you get these angry comments both from the US and from the European Union too.
Are these sort of the preamble to something we might call a U.S.-China trade war?
Well, I doubt it. I mean, certainly there's a lot of anger on both sides, but I think that it's probably not likely to happen. This is kind of what happens and what has always happened. You have a lot of bad blood and complaints on either side, but I don't think there's any there would be anything to gain from either of these countries engaging in a full-scale trade war. I mean, last year when President Obama slapped the tariffs on tires, people said that was going to be the start of on cheap Chinese tires, that was going to be the start of a trade war. And actually, as the months went on, the US complaints started to taper off a little. So I think we're definitely a long way away from a trade war.
BBC's Chris Hogg joining us from Shanghai, talking about sniping about currency, but far short of a trade war. Finally, top grossing movie this weekend, Alice in Wonderland from Tim Burton. The movie earned around $62 million in box office. Green Zone, the Iraq War thriller, was a distant number two, and She's Out of My League debuted at number three. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that adventure.
It is Monday, and here on The Takeaway, that means we talk about family. And today, a really hot topic, one that has become increasingly politicized and polarizing among moms and health advocates. And that topic, of course, is breastfeeding.
You know, it's a big issue in our house. I mean, that's what's going on.
Dare I ask?
Yes. Well, no, we are a breastfeeding household.
Well, you have a new baby and indeed. A new-ish baby. And
we've got the pump. We've got the whole thing.
Yeah. So you're doing it. Well, then you know what the issues are. Over the past two decades, the mantra has been breast is best, particularly among college-educated women and older mothers. But now, John, the pendulum may be swinging back to formula is fine.
Well, there are management issues with the breastfeeding. Where I mean, it may feel good to have that sort of bonding with the baby, but managing that and staying connected to the baby on basically a two-hour tether for 24/7, I mean, is really, really difficult.
And, of course, as you know, and as I bet most of our – well, moms do need a break, but as most of our listeners no doubt know, the benefits of breastfeeding have been – touted as doing everything from preventing obesity to improving IQ.
Right. Immune system
being primary. However, lots of women have said, as you just pointed out, number one, it's painful. Number two, it complicates life in a way. I don't mean that in a flip way, but that it doesn't always work. In any event, let's talk about that now. With Dr. Phyllis Rippey-Young, she is assistant professor of sociology at Acadia University in Nova Scotia, Canada, and she is co-author of a working paper on the economic consequences of breastfeeding, something we haven't thought about before. Dr. Rippey-Young, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Now, the paper you're co-authoring indicates that all the stuff John and I have been talking about, it may be more than just stressful and guilt-laden for some mothers. Breastfeeding may also have potentially negative economic consequences. What are they?
Well, we don't find that there's an impact of breastfeeding on earnings for those who breastfeed for less than 6 months. But there is a significant and large impact for those who do it for 6 months or longer, which is how long women are recommended to do it. So these women's earnings are mostly affected because they either stop working or they move to part-time work. But my co-author, Mary Noonan, and I are only able to examine the impact of breastfeeding for those women who go ahead and actually breastfeed. It's highly possible that many of the women who do not breastfeed choose not to because they know they wouldn't be able to combine full-time work and breastfeeding. And they can't afford to quit work or they don't want to jeopardize their careers. So it may be that the average impact would be even larger than we observe in our sample.
Okay, but wait a minute. Yeah. You're saying that there's an economic downturn because the women are not available to go back to work sooner. But what about the benefits, the economic benefits? I mean, you don't have to pay for formula if
it's
you breastfeed.
It's expensive stuff.
Absolutely, and we're not doing a full cost-benefit analysis, so it's very possible that that there are other economic benefits like not having to pay for formula and all that stuff. But it's also the case that if breastfeeding were normalized and if breastfeeding were normalized in a way to make it possible for women to carry out breastfeeding, there could be no impact at all.
Well, really, that's what surprises me because I would have thought that workplaces are much more flexible on the issue of breastfeeding at work. But you're saying the data shows that maybe that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. I would say that despite all these exhortations for women to breastfeed, it's absolutely the case that most American employers are highly unsupportive of breastfeeding. And that really, if we want people to breastfeed because people claim that there are these health benefits to it, there needs to be more questions asked, like why aren't there publicly available lactation stations? Why isn't there publicly available daycare or contributions to pensions? Because these economic penalties, they aren't just about women not being able to take vacations or having enough pocket money, but this means that women are going to have less money to put into their pensions, to put into savings, which has an impact if they're to be widowed or divorced or something happens to them.
Let's. I know, Dr. Rippey-Young, that you have focused on the economic aspects of this, but I wonder if in your research you have come across the political aspects of it as well. I mean, there are groups out there who don't want to hear that maybe formula is fine.
Well, and we're not saying the formula is fine. We're not saying really what any woman should do. I think that every woman needs to make decisions about their lives in ways that make sense for them. But I think that what people should be taking away from this message is not that formula is fine, but that women should be getting angry that no matter what decision they make about breastfeeding, whether they do it or not, but they're being penalized, either financially or they're being told that they're bad mothers. And there's something wrong with that picture.
excuse me. What about the economic cost of breastfeeding itself? All that equipment is expensive, right?
Sure. sure, there are costs for breastfeeding like that. And I think that that needs to be taken into account in terms of what we're asking of women. That if
I mean, we're talking about pumps. We're talking
then,
about pumps and things like that, correct?
Right. But again, we don't do a cost-benefit analysis of all of those things. We're only looking at women's earnings over time.
When you say that employers should be doing something more about this, do you believe there should – well, of course, you're in Canada. You're not in the States. But yeah. Do you believe there should be legislation, or is this something that employers simply ought to be doing on their own?
I think that there has to be legislation. I think that without legislation, employers are not going to be doing it on their own. And so I know that Representative Carolyn Maloney has a breastfeeding bill, and I think that that needs to be supported. But again, I'm not telling women what they should do. I'm not trying to tell women that they should breastfeed or that they shouldn't breastfeed. But if we're going to be, if women are going to be told that they're doing something wrong by not breastfeeding, then there needs to be something put in place so that women aren't penalized when they do what they're told that they're supposed to be doing.
And this will only keep the argument going and make it an even hotter topic. Dr. Phyllis Rippey-Young, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. Thanks very much for joining us. John?
Weigh in on that topic or anything on the program. You can also re-listen to anything at thetakeaway.org. And while you're at our site, get your take. We want to get your take on the census, from why it's important to why some communities are shrinking, and also the further adventures.
The further adventures of Larry Cogswell, official census taker. He is America.
Census taking is America. So call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Do you see population shifts in your community? Tell us. Be our eyes on the ground. And also, remember, you can help with the Takeaway T-shirt contest. That's all at our website. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scher in for Celeste Headley.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.